Hi, everybody. My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March the 31st of 1990. I have a home group, the Gunnersville Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're right on the Tennessee River. I have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor. My sponsor is Father Francis. Some of you may know him. He lives in Cullman at the Abbey. I'm a Roman Catholic priest. All of those things are absolutely true. What you're going to hear from here on out is just kind of my perception of what's real. My sobriety, my life, your influence in my life, it's all perception. And my happiness is directly tied to how I perceive what's going on. But thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I do much better with it today than I did before. I'm going to share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Dirk for inviting me to come to speak. I want to thank Walt and Kelly for being such gracious hosts. And for everybody that's on the committee here, I know that a lot of work went into making this happen. We couldn't have this beautiful retreat without the committee. So give the committee a hand. The speakers so far have been great. Marie, Dave, thank you. Looking forward to hearing Jim's story. I grew up in a family. There were two parents, five kids, and usually a dog. I guess that kind of depended on how the dog acted, whether he got to stick around or not. I'm not quite sure how all that worked when I was a kid. I was the fourth of five. I had two older sisters, an older brother, and a younger brother. By the time I got into high school, I think my parents were just tired. I didn't have a whole lot of, there weren't a whole lot of restrictions on me, I guess, by the time I got to high school. I was a good student, average, above average student, above average athlete. I was relatively popular. And I didn't feel like I was any of that. I kind of felt like a square peg in a round hole, if you will. I can't tell you that I felt that all the way growing up, but I never felt like I measured up. I just had this weird feeling. But I remember a particular night. It was in early September of 1972. I was a sophomore in high school. It was a Friday night. I was 14 years old. I was soon to be 15, though. And someone said, "We're having a party at so-and-so's house. Parents are gone. There's going to be some beer. There's going to be music. There's going to be girls." And I thought, oh, man, that sounds great. And let me just tell you something, that 3 out of 4 isn't bad. Because there was beer, there was music, parents were gone, girls never showed up. But after a while, it just didn't matter. I had my first taste of beer. And I know exactly what the big book is talking about. When in the doctor's opinion it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't particularly care for the taste. In fact, I had about a half a beer and I thought, geez, how does anybody drink this? But after 30, 40, 50 seconds, I figured it out. My mind just started to make me feel a little more comfortable in my own skin. And so I had more. And that night I got drunk. I didn't get fall down staggering drunk. I went home, didn't get into any particular trouble. And I thought, one of these days I'm going to do that again. And it was probably a few weeks later when I had the opportunity to do it again. And for the next few months, I probably had the opportunity to do it once or twice a month. I remember New Year's Eve of 1972, 1973, and I was already 15, so I was much more mature at that point. And I ended up, it involved fake IDs and Chinese restaurants and walk-in where it was really cold. People, you know, didn't really care. And so I drank hard liquor really for the first time and ended up going to a party. And I remember going to the party. I remember being at the party. I remember talking to some people at the party. And then the next memory that I have is the next morning. And it was late in the morning. And my brother, who was 13 months older than me, always so very, very helpful in helping me to remember what it was I said and did. And I just thought, I couldn't have said that. He goes, oh yeah, you did. I couldn't have done that. Oh yeah, you did. Am I in trouble? Yeah, probably. I think my parents felt that I had learned my lesson. But I had what I was soon to, you know, eventually to understand, that was my first blackout. So at the age of 15, I became a blackout drinker. I didn't black out every time I drank, by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, coincidentally, the only time I ever blacked out was when I drank. I didn't put that together until much later in my life. I ended up, in my family, alcohol was prevalent. I've heard what some of you have said. My father drank pretty heavily. Died at a very relatively early age, about just a little older than I am right now. And he was one of those people that was very intelligent, very capable. He could build anything, it seemed like. And he worked in the insurance business. He was an insurance adjuster. And so he gave us, we were far from wealthy, but he never seemed happy. Like the kind of not happy that he wished he were doing something else. That's what it always seemed like. And he was probably capable of doing other things. He just had five kids and needed to raise the kids. And he drank pretty heavily, and he was verbally and physically abusive. I know now that his two brothers drank real heavily, and my two uncles, they drank real heavily, but my grandparents didn't drink at all, not a drop. And I remember I was a year sober when I talked to my grandmother and said, Grandma, I've got over a year of continuous sobriety. And she said, well, that's great. I've got 96 years of continuous sobriety. You know, all I'm doing is what I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm trying to get the pats on the back, right? I was trying to get that all of my life. I was trying to get the accolades and the pats on. You know, all I'm doing is just the average thing, exactly what I was supposed to do. Well, I went through high school, and I had occasional blackouts. I ended up drinking pretty much all the way through high school. In fact, I was going to reflect back after I came into AA, and it dawned on me after being sober for about 2 weeks at that time that I couldn't remember the last time I was 2 weeks completely sober. And I figured I must have been 15, maybe 16 years old when I was 2 weeks completely sober. That was a kind of an eye-opening experience. The book talks about me a lot. I'm pretty sure that the book talks about a lot of you too. It took me a while to figure out that the book was talking about me, but they knew about me. They knew about me really well. And, you know, it's taken years for me to to continue to learn more about myself. And I can look in here and see exactly what it talks about. I don't recall in high school ever saying, I'm going to quit. Again, you know, I was an above average student. I was a good athlete. I was relatively popular. Why quit? I never, you know, never really gave it much thought. But probably the first time that I can recall back and say, you know, if it's going to cause me this much trouble, I'm going to stop. I was 19 years old, and I got into a car accident. I got into a car accident. It was St. Patrick's Day, and it snowed like crazy, and I wrecked my car, and it went into the shop. And a week later, a friend of mine called and said, we're having a party at my house. Come on over. Well, you know, I'd already told myself, if it's going to cause me this much trouble, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'd already told myself that. And this friend of mine said, come on over, we're having a party. Well, I'm not going to drink because, you know, it caused me a lot of trouble. Well, you know, you don't have to worry so much about that. You know, well, my car's in the shop. Yeah, but I only live 6 blocks away. You can walk over. Oh, well, okay, all right, but I'm not gonna drink. Okay. And then I got over there and I said, well, I'm not gonna drink that much. And, you know, a week later I get my car back and but I'm definitely not gonna drink and drive. That's what I said that first night. And then I got my car back and it's like, well, I'm not gonna drink that much when I drive. And it wasn't long before I was right back to where I was. We all know that story. It's that idea, the phenomenon of craving that the doctor's opinion talks about. There were a number of different incidents and issues going on. I drank from the time I was 15 until the time I was 32, 14 actually, 14 to 32. And so I drank for about 17 and a half years, and I had several incidents that were like that. And I told myself, oh man, I gotta change. I gotta do something. But the idea of not drinking again wasn't one of those somethings. That really wasn't much of an option for me. I learned how to socialize drinking. I couldn't really talk to people in a social situation unless I was drinking. I mean, it seems kind of funny, but that's just the way that it was for me. And I ended up running into several stumbling blocks as I went along, but I was always able to overcome them, and I was always able to just say, okay, well, you know, I didn't really need to do that anyway, and so I just kind of lower expectations. Well, I didn't really need to do that anyway, and I just lower expectations. When I graduated from college, I thought that what I was going to do was a law enforcement job, a federal law enforcement job. And I took the test, and I did really well on it. The funny thing is, though, that 60 hours after I picked up my diploma, I got my first official DUI. And they don't really want people that have a drinking issue. They're not really looking for those kind of people because those kinds of jobs sometimes cause those kinds of problems. They don't need someone that's already got it going in. And so I wasn't able to take that job. I did well on the tests, and they said, yeah, come, you know, go to the next stage. And the next stage was the background. And, you know, I had to fill in the report. It's like, have you ever been arrested? Well, yes, I was, as a matter of fact, just not even very long ago. And, you know, so that kind of eliminated me for that. So it's like, you would think the normal drinker would say, oh man, if it's going to cause that much trouble, I'm going to stop. But not me. I'm going to cut back for now. And that's really kind of how it was. I could never admit that I was powerless over alcohol. The thought never came to me. I never considered it. Well, you've got an idea, I think, of kind of how my drinking went from the time I was 14 or 15 up until I was 32. I continued to run into these speed bumps on the road to success. Every once in a while I'd pull it off into the ditch, but I'd get back together, and I'd rally, and then I'd be okay again, I guess. I got another DUI about 6.5 years later, and that one was right near the end. I was successful. I had a good job. I had a lot of responsibility. I did a number of good things for the company that I was working for, and they appreciated and approved it. And I had just been promoted and transferred from one location to another. Just a few weeks into that, I was in a company car and I got a DUI. I've heard since I've come in that alcoholism is progressive, chronic, and fatal. And I've heard that on those on the Chalk Talks by Father Martin. Some of you are familiar with that. And I heard that when I was in education after I got this second DUI. Progressive, chronic, and fatal. Let me tell you about progressive from my perspective, but I can tell you what chronic and fatal was only from my father's perspective. So I'm going to share just a moment about my father's chronic and fatal. I already told you that he was a very intelligent, very capable man. I don't really remember him ever going to the doctor when I was growing up. I don't really remember him ever having any kind of a health issue. But I knew from the time I was about 9 years old, someone said, "Your father's an alcoholic." I immediately knew that, yeah, that's the problem. That's the issue. Well, when my father got to be about 55 or 56, the health problems started to really mount up. And they seemed to mount up just out of almost nowhere. But you could see that the alcoholism was really beginning to take over. Or the heavy drinking. I shouldn't call it alcoholism. The heavy drinking was really beginning to take over for him. He was retired early from the company that he worked for, I think at about the age of 58 or 59. And he moved down to my grandparents' farm, his parents' farm, at that point. And he was kind of at that point in the beyond progressive. He was in chronic illness. He had heart failure. He ended up dying from cirrhosis of the liver. From pancreatic cancer. But they also found that he had cirrhosis of the liver. He was one of those people that you couldn't really carry on a conversation with him the last year of his life. He really couldn't do anything for himself the last year of his life. And it took his life right as within a few days of him turning 62. My grandmother, his mother, died at the age of 102. My grandfather, his father, died at the age of 91. So theoretically, he had the genetic background to be able to live a longer period of time. But heavy drinking, don't know that it was alcoholism. I'll explain that in a minute, what I understand what alcoholism is. Heavy drinking took his life much too early. For me, I want to explain what progressive was. I told you about that first DUI right after I graduated from college. I was drunk that night. There's no doubt in my mind. I'd been a lot more drunk than that. I'd driven. I'm not proud of it, but I'd driven a lot more drunk that night. That night, I didn't go into a blackout. I didn't pass out. I remember everything that happened to me. And what they asked me to do was blow into the meter, and I blew 0.155 or something like that. Today, that's twice the legal limit. But then it was just over the legal limit of 0.15. But they said, "Well, you're over the limit. We have to give you the ticket." Okay. 6.5 years later, same thing. I was pulled over, and I'd driven much more drunk a number of times. I didn't black out that night. I didn't pass out that night. I remember everything that happened that night. And when I blew into the meter, I was 0.306. Today, that's almost 4 times the legal limit. What that really means was that I was able to consume a lot of alcohol and still be able to move around, still be able to somewhat function. So for me, I had progressed from one stage all the way up to, you know, a lot. From what today is twice the legal limit to 4 times the legal limit, didn't really feel all that different. Didn't really affect me all that differently. I was sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of that DUI. I had a lot of different things I had to do. I lost my license for a little while, although they gave me a permit to drive for work. I remember sitting with the probation officer, and she said, you know, we're going to have you go to AA meetings. And I didn't know how many. She was about to tell me it was something 30, 35, 40. It was a lot of meetings. It wasn't just a couple. And you're going to need to get your card signed. And I said, well, you know, you don't have to send me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an alcoholic. See, here's why I wasn't an alcoholic. You have your own reasons why you weren't an alcoholic. Mine was I still had a job. Mine was I still had a place to live. Mine was I still had a car. Mine was I hadn't lost a house or a family, or I didn't live under the bridge. I didn't fill in the blanks. You've got your own reasons for thinking that you might not have been an alcoholic when later on you discovered maybe you were. So I had all of these excuses why I wasn't an alcoholic and why I couldn't be an alcoholic. And I said, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. Don't send me to AA meetings. Just make me pick up trash on the side of the road. She said, and I quote, oh, you'll pick up trash on the side of the road, all right, but you're still going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, okay, let me just quit while I'm behind. And so I went, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and having to get a card signed. That was really kind of embarrassing, but it was kind of a humbling experience. At that time, it was a humiliating experience, but today I recognize it more as a humbling experience. I went to these. I started going to meetings, and I went to this group in Shreveport, Louisiana, where I got sober. It was called the Happy Hour Group. It met in the. There was a hospital there that had a treatment center that was attached to the hospital, and it met at the treatment center every noon. Might have been 12:15, but it was a noontime meeting. That was, and they met 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and so that kind of became my home group, if you will. But I remember a couple of weeks in, someone said, "Let's go to the Promises group," and I asked, "What are the Promises?" And I was introduced to the Promises. It didn't mean much to me. I was introduced to an awful lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous in those 63 days. I stayed sober for 63 days, and I fulfilled the obligation that I was supposed to fulfill. And I began to hear things that I needed to hear, without question. I began to hear things that I needed to hear. I heard, of all things, there were people that drank like I did. There were people that were normal in every sense of the word in my own mind that were in AA meetings. I thought, there are normal people in here. I didn't know. I remember going to my first meeting. I actually went to my first two or three meetings. I parked 2.5 blocks away because, of course, no one in Alcoholics Anonymous has a driver's license, right? That's what I thought. Nobody has a driver's. And so I walked out like the second meeting, and there were people that had parked right in the parking lot. And I thought, I asked this guy, I said, you know, don't the police come and take down license tag numbers here or something? And he said, oh, no. Why would they do that? I go, because people don't have their driver's license. He goes, I've got a driver's license. You do? That's what it's like, I had no idea. I had no idea at all. Well, I began to hear things at those meetings in the first 63 days. And I got my card signed, and I was grateful. And I planned to come back. But I also planned to take a vacation. And while I was on that vacation, I drank again. And I drank for 2 more weeks. And I guess that was what I needed to do, but by the grace of God, I was able to come back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember drinking the very first night, and something came to me. It was something that someone had said somewhere, sometime in my life, and I knew that it was in those last 63 days. If, when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit drinking entirely, or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you drink, then you're probably alcoholic. You know, that's on page 44. That's the beginning paragraph of the chapter to the agnostic. And it's interesting because I'd read that in those first 63 days. And I know that I read that very simply because they said, get a big book. And so somewhere around 30 days, you know, I didn't get it right away, somewhere around 30 days, I bought a big book. And then I started thumbing through the table of contents, and I got, oh, look, chapter 4, We Agnostics. That's exactly what I thought I was. Someone that just didn't pay much attention to God. Someone that didn't have the knowledge of God. Agnostic really means against knowledge. And so I didn't really fight that there wasn't a God, but I didn't really pay much attention to the fact that there was. I had this sense of God. I had a sense that there was a creator of the universe, but I'm not really sure what else I really believed. I didn't pay much attention to it. Most of my life, I'd just kind of gone on self-propulsion, or so I thought. I've discovered that God's hand was in a lot of different things as I was growing up, and as I was drinking. Well, so the first thing that I did when I bought the big book was I started reading We Agnostics because I thought that's where I belonged. You know, there's no reason to start at the beginning of a book, right? Why would you do that? Well, so I must have read that. I must have read that then. And here I am drinking in a bar, taking the drink. It's like, and I really didn't want a drink. But I said, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit drinking entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you drink, then you're probably an alcoholic. And I thought, for the very first time, after having been sober for 63 days and now drunk, I think I'm an alcoholic. In that meeting at the treatment center that I went to, the happy hour group, I look back, I didn't know it at the time, but it had to be a beginner's meeting. Like 5 days a week, it must have been a beginner's meeting because they read from More About Alcoholism. They read from Bill's story some. They read from We Agnostics. That's kind of what the meeting topics were about coming into AA. And that's exactly what I needed to hear. In the doctor's opinion, he talks about the phenomenon of craving. And when I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous after those 2 weeks, that's exactly what I could describe. That's exactly what went on in me. was the phenomenon of craving. And it, you know, he talks about it. He says, you know, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. But before that, he says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. I had no control over how much I drank once I started. None. And I can tell you, I've got proof for that. And here's my proof that the phenomenon of craving is absolutely true. I never once walked out of my house and said, tonight is going to be a great night to go into a blackout. Tonight is going to be a wonderful night to wreck my car. Tonight's going to be a good night. Oh, you know what? I think I'm going to spend every dollar in my wallet and not have any more money until next payday. I never once did any of that. But all of those things happened only when I was drinking. It didn't happen every time I drank. But when it happened, it was because I was drinking. So that phenomenon of craving is something that's very close to my heart. I fully understand that. So I can't stop once I start, but I've got this crazy thing that goes on in my mind where I can't stop starting. I can't stop starting. You know, it's going to be different this time. I'm not going to drink that much when I go out. It was just like when I was 19 and I wrecked my car. Well, I'm not going to drink. Well, okay, but I'm not going to drink that much. Well, okay, but I'm not going to drink and drive anymore, that's for sure. Well, I'm not going to drink as much when I drive, that's for sure. I can't stop once I start, but I can't stop starting. I've got this issue. You know, it talks about it. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that one day he'll control and enjoy his drinking. Okay? That's paraphrasing from More About Alcoholism. Right? Well, I was control and enjoy. The word there is and. I could control it at the end. Okay? I could control it. I never became an everyday drinker. That was another reason why I couldn't be an alcoholic. I was a weekend binge drinker. You know, I could control my drinking, but I didn't enjoy it. Like if I had to be at a business function or something, I could have one beer, but then I just kind of felt nervous and I was really uncomfortable. I surely didn't enjoy it. Or I could enjoy it and I was completely out of control. So I could either control it or enjoy it. I couldn't control and enjoy. So this book talks about me in a number of different places. I came in on March the 31st of 1990. I got off an airplane and I knew I was defeated. On the airplane back from Europe, on the airplane ride, I was telling myself, I've got to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God lots of strange things happened in that 2 weeks, but nothing bad happened in that 2 weeks, luckily. And I came back. I went into alcohol. I went back to that home group, the happy hour group. And you know what they did? They said, welcome back. They didn't ask me what step I'd been working on when I drank. They didn't chastise me for going out and taking a drink. They merely said, boy, I'm glad you made it back. Those are the three or four people that I talked to quite a bit, you know, in those first 63 days. Welcome back. Glad you made it. One guy said, yeah, I didn't think you were going to make it through 2 weeks in Europe without taking a drink. Boy, I'm sure glad you're here. I mean, that was the welcome I got when I came back. And I was really grateful for that. I wasn't judged. And I want to tell you about a couple of really important meetings. One I'm going to tell you about right now, and a little bit later, I'm going to talk about the second one. I was probably 45 days sober. And I'd heard about the steps. I'd heard a great deal about the steps in those first 63 days, and I'd heard about the steps, working a sponsor, or getting a sponsor, working the steps, going to meetings. I heard about all of that in the first 63 days, but I thought, that's for people who are worse off than me. That's for people that need that. That wasn't me. I didn't need that. That's what I thought. And when I came back in, I had absolutely no intention of trying to apply the steps in my program. None whatsoever. And I was about 45 days sober this go round. So this would have been the middle of May of 1990. And I went into the Haven Club in downtown Shreveport, Louisiana. And back then, there was no such thing as a non-smoking meeting. This club certainly wasn't a non-smoking club. This was one of those places where, you know, if you came in, you know, they checked you for cigarettes, and if you didn't have any, they issued them to you. You know, it was one of those places, you know. And like the smoke was real thick, real heavy, but everybody was laughing. Everybody was enjoying each other's company. This was a Saturday night in the middle of May, and they opened up the meeting. They probably read how it works. They weren't much into the traditions or the promises reading in meetings, but you know, then they did something that we talked about here the other night. Dirk and I were talking about it before Thursday night's meeting. Oh, it's terrible when somebody opens the meeting and says, "Does anyone have a topic they'd like to discuss?" Well, let me tell you something, that was the single most important meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that to that moment had ever taken place, as far as I was concerned. Simply because after they did all that stuff, somebody in the back of the room said, "Why should I do a fourth step?" And that became the topic of the meeting. And there were several people in that meeting that I knew. But I can't tell you exactly what any of them said, except just about everybody brought out the idea that if I wasn't ready to do a fourth step, I wasn't really ready to stay sober yet. That's maybe not even what anybody said, but that's what I heard. If I wasn't ready to do the steps, I wasn't quite ready to stay sober yet. And that night, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, I asked a guy to be my sponsor. I was never going to do that. What do I need to do that for? Jim, will you be my sponsor? Yeah, I'd be honored. You would? You know, I got all of these responses that I didn't really expect. And so I said, "I think I'm ready to do a fourth step." And he says, "Well, let's back up a little bit." And he said, we'll go through the first few steps. And then we'll be ready. That didn't take very long. We sat down and talked. And that idea, you know, I had to concede to my innermost self that I was really an alcoholic. I had to come to the realization that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. That wasn't all that easy to do. And to tell you the truth, it took really a couple of years for me to fully understand the implications of being powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. It took a while, but I was ready to go. And it's like, yep, I am powerless over alcohol. And we talked about some of the things. We talked about the blackouts. We talked about the phenomenon of craving. We talked about those things. And then he said, "Is there hope for you?" Yeah, I think so. Well, good. That's the second step. Now let's move on. And so we did. And he pointed out in the big book where it talks about something that's real near and dear to my heart. selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and self-seeking, we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. Selfishness, self-centeredness? I never thought of myself that way, really. But once I started thinking of myself that way, it was pretty easy to think of myself that way. I think that's the issue. And all of that took place over the course of a day or two, that whole going through 1 through 3. And he said, I think you're ready to start writing. Well, how do I do it? And he says, well, look in the book. And I'm sorry, I didn't understand this format in the book. And I don't think I'm the only one that ever walked into AA that didn't understand this format. My proof for that is that there are all sorts of published type articles and published type papers on how to do a four-step. But it's right here. I was much too, I don't even know the word. Intelligent isn't the word. Maybe much too analytical to really understand what this was saying. Well, take out a piece of paper and write on top, resentments. I'm resentful at, in the first column. Why I'm resentful at. What does it cause in me? And then, finally, over in the last column, which I didn't get to on my first four step, you know, where was I at fault? What was my issue? What was my part in that resentment? Well, my sponsor was, a very wise man. And he said, I don't want you to go home and spend a month on this. What I want you to do is take about 2 or 3 hours for 2, maybe 3 days, and write this out. Write out your resentment list. What are you resentful at? You can write that out in a couple of hours. Yeah, they'll come right to the front of my mind. And then write down what your fears are. Well, I don't have any fears. He said, you don't? He said, you know, I'm afraid of everything and its opposite. I find it hard to believe that you, Tim, don't have any fears. He was right. Boy, was he right. And then sit down and write the sex inventory. And he said, read it. It's really pretty simple. There's not too much to it. Don't worry about it. Don't go to one extreme or the other. Think about the idea that, you know, what ideals are we trying to shape as we move forward? If you fall short, don't worry about it. Fix it. Okay. So I sat down and I made the most searching and fearless moral inventory that I possibly could do at that time. Before I was 60 days sober, I can tell you that. I'd done a fifth step by the time I was 60 days sober or less. Without question, I'd done that. It was as searching and fearless as I could possibly be. There were some things that I didn't put on the list. And at a couple of years sober, a little less than a couple of years sober, I did another four step that was much more searching, much more fearless. And that didn't take nearly as long because everything was right there at the forefront. Okay, write it down. Not an issue. So I'd done a fifth step, and I remember, I know what it says in the big book about it. There are some promises that are associated with the fifth step in the big book. We're going to feel like we're a part of this thing. And that's exactly how I felt. I didn't feel like a spiritual experience or what the book talks about. I didn't feel that. But what I felt after I sat down and talked to Jim about this was I felt like I belonged. I felt like I had earned a chair someplace. Now, I'd been successful at several different things by the time I was 32 years old. Not wildly successful, or not rich or anything like that, but I'd done okay. But I never felt like I quite belonged until I did a fifth step. Then I felt like I belonged in AA. I felt like I was a part of. As I went along, I made a list, like it said. I asked God to remove these defects of character, but he saw fit to keep some of them around. Not all that thrilled with some of that, but, you know, I made a major amend before I was 4 months sober. It was an amend that I thought I would never be able to make. It was a financial amend to a former employer. I thought I'd never be able to make this amend. And I had talked to Jim about that, and he said, pray about it. Yeah, okay. Well, as luck would have it, I don't call it luck anymore. I call it, I don't even call it a coincidence. I think that coincidences happen when God chooses to remain anonymous. But a coincidence happened. I got a bonus check. And it was a substantial bonus check. And I thought, this would cover that whole financial amend that I need to make, which wasn't that big of a deal, but it was a lot of money for me at that time. And I talked to Jim, and he said, oh, that looks like you're able to make that financial amend. Yeah. And so we figured out a way to do that. And so I was on my way. I was moving along, and it worked out pretty well. I was about 9 months sober, and you know, I'd been learning some of the prayers in AA. When I walked into AA, I haven't always been a priest. I'll get to that, I promise. I haven't always been a priest, and when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw God as we understood him. I talked about, you know, I saw the steps on the wall, and I thought, oh no, this is going to be a religious program. I'm in big trouble. But I have to be here to get my card signed. And I discovered the difference between a religious program and a spiritual program. What some people early on explained was that a religious program is for people who are trying to avoid hell. A spiritual program is for people who have already been there. Boy, did that make sense to me. And so I started following the spiritual program after I started working the steps. That third step prayer was one that became really important. Really important, because it was so simple. But I didn't know how to pray when I walked in. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulty, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do your will always. You know, for me to memorize something like that and be able to say it over and over again, I needed to sit down and break it apart and analyze what it meant. God, I'm giving myself over to you to make me the man that you need me to be. Relieve me of the bondage of myself. And, you know, if you look at where that's placed in the big book, on page 65, what, 63? On page 62, just before that, it tells me that selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our trouble. It tells me that's my problem. Relieve me of the bondage of that self that I found on the page before. Take away my difficulties that others might be able to see your power, your love, your way of life. I had to sit down and analyze what all of these prayers in AA really meant for me in order for me to learn them. Same thing with the seven-step prayer. God, I'm now ready that you should have all of me, good and bad. You know what? That places me in a position not to be able to judge anymore what's good and what's bad, because I've just turned it all over to God. I ask that you take from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Boy, I wish it just said, take from me every single defect of character, period. end of sentence, but it says, that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. So I still had selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, fear, resentment, anger. I heard a guy say one time, he was a speaker back in the 90s. Was down in Montgomery, and he said something that really stuck with me. He said that resentment, anger, and fear are the same thing on a time continuum. And he said that resentment is the word that he uses to describe the feeling that he has when he realizes that he hasn't gotten his way sometime in the past. Fear is the word that he uses to describe the feeling that he has when he thinks he's not going to get his way sometime in the future. And anger is the word that he uses to describe the feeling that he has when he's not getting his way right now. Boy, did that make sense. You know, this is so pragmatic, so useful, so easily adaptable to who we are. I don't know why more people don't really look to this program, because it's so simple. It's not always easy, but it's simple. You know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Let me tell you where that fit in. At about 9.5 months sober, I was asked to come and visit with my boss. I lived in Shreveport. He was in Baton Rouge. As I recall, it's about a four-hour drive. And he wanted me to consider taking a job in Birmingham. And I said, okay. So I drove down there, and I get into Baton Rouge. I'm 10 minutes, 20 minutes from his office, 15, whatever it is. And I said, you know, in AA, they told me I should pray about things like this. And I just couldn't think of a prayer. Like, no, now I lay me down to sleep. No, you didn't want that one. How about God grant me the serenity? No, not that one. Our Father who art, no, not that one. The one that came to me was this. Give me the knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry it out. That's the only prayer I could think to say. Give me the knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry it out. And I walked in, sat down. My boss was a friend, you know, we were friendly. And we talked about the office in Birmingham and the territory. And everything went really well. I walked out of that office, and we spent pretty much the day, and I started driving back. And it started to rain like it can only rain in Louisiana, I think. And it's like you can't drive anymore. Like your windshield wipers, they don't make them that go fast enough for these huge downpours. And so what I did is I pulled off on the side. And as I got to a stop, all of a sudden, it was like a voice. It wasn't a voice. I don't want anyone to think I was hearing voices, okay? It was like a voice that said, I answered your prayer. And I think I may have said an audible, what? And I knew what it said. I answered your prayer. I had never before had an experience of God. I had a belief in God. But at that moment, I had this electric feeling that God was right there with me. And from that moment to this, I know that God has been with me. I'm able to look back and see where God has been. Well, I took the job in Birmingham, and I did pretty well at it for about a year and a half, and then another half a year, I didn't do so well, and I got fired from that job. I'd worked for that company for 9 years. I thought that I would stay with that company for my entire career, just like my dad had stayed with the company he'd worked for, and I lost that job, and I was devastated, but I had AA, and at that time, I was about 2.5 years sober, which was a good thing. I had AA friends to be able to rely on, and I was able to make it through that. Got another job, and that job transferred me to Macon, Georgia from Birmingham. And I spent 15 months in Macon. I mentioned that there's a second meeting that I went to. And this second meeting, I can tell you exactly when it happened. It was a Friday night. It was March the 31st of 1995. It was my fifth anniversary in AA. And a friend of mine, Gladys, asked me, where are you going to celebrate, you know, your anniversary? I said, well, I don't really know. Home group doesn't meet that night. Well, why don't you come to the Catholic church where the new priest in town is going to tell his story? Okay, fine, no problem. Well, I'd heard priests tell their stories before. I'd gone to a couple of conventions and listened to some speaker tapes and things like that. So it wasn't a big deal. And so I went down to the basement. There were about 10 people in the meeting, and I met Father Jim. Father Jim told his story. It wasn't a particularly great speaker, great talk, AA talk, but he had a spirituality about him that I wanted to kind of tap into. And for the last couple of years, I'd really been searching for God. I'd gone back to church and felt kind of comfortable there, but it was the Lutheran church. Don't blame the Lutherans. They did the very best they could with what they had to work with. She invited me to come to the church, and I heard him, and she said, well, why don't you come to church with me, tomorrow night? And I said, well, I'm not Catholic. Yeah, but that's okay. You've been to Catholic Mass before. I said, yeah. So I went, and I met Father Jim, talked to him a little more at length, and he said, why don't you call me on Monday? So I called him. We sat down. We became fast friends. He was 65 years old. He had lived in Macon he grew up in Macon. But when he was 18, he said, I'm leaving and I'm never coming back. And until 3 weeks before that, he'd never come back. He'd come back for his parents' funeral, and he came back for one or two class reunions over almost 50 years. But all of a sudden, he was back in Macon. And so was I. Coincidence? I don't know. Well, I soon started taking lessons to become Catholic. And my mom came for a visit around Thanksgiving of 1995. And she came to church with me, which was, again, geez, really? You're going to come to church with me? My mom was one of those people that she'd go to church if there was a funeral, maybe Christmas once in a while, but not very often. And I really thought she'd say, nah, I'm just going to sit here. But she came down, she met Father Jim. And Jim and I would go to dinner every now and then, and the following Wednesday, we went to dinner. I could look on a calendar and tell you this date. We were talking, and he said, what does your mother think of you becoming Catholic? Well, I think she's going to be happy that I'm happy. That's great. What's she going to say when you tell her you're going to become a priest? What? What? He says, what's she going to say when you tell her you're going to become a priest? That thought had never entered into my mind. Never. I mean, even I knew that you had to be Catholic in order to be a priest, and I wasn't Catholic. How can I be a priest? I can't think about that. And so, from that moment to this, the thought of being a priest really hasn't been very far from my mind. But I think I answered him by saying, well, why don't you just let me become Catholic first? And he said, okay. And just a few weeks later, we were talking, and I said, something's been bothering me. He goes, yeah, that thought about becoming a priest. I said, yeah, how did you know? He says, well, if it's meant to be, the thought will stay, and if it's not, it'll go away. Okay. Well, it never went away. After about 5 years of, about 4 years of being Catholic, I applied and was accepted to the seminary. So after 20 years in the business world, I left and went to the seminary. I absolutely love what I do, had no idea. I enjoyed what I did before, but I love what I'm doing today. I'm the pastor in a small church in Gunnersville, Alabama. I've got people that love me and people that don't. That's okay. I'll be there until the bishop tells me otherwise, and then I'll move somewhere else in North Alabama. I love the spirituality of AA because it's so simple. It's so easy. You know, when you look, that idea of looking in the rearview mirror and being able to understand life, well, that's absolutely true, but that came from this guy named Soren Kierkegaard back in the 18th century. He talked about the idea of life being lived forward, but only understood when we look back. Well, that's the 10th step. Continue to take personal inventory. You know, looking back on our lives. That's where we see the hand of God in our lives. The only time, not all the time, but most of the time, the only way that you're going to see where God's worked is to look back and recognize it. I don't get a chance to see where God's going to be. A couple of times in my life, very fortunately, I've seen where God is. That was when I was in Macon. Hated Macon. Not Macon. Hated the job I had in Macon. But I knew why I was there. I was there to meet Gladys. I was there to meet Jim. I was there to meet Adam. You know, I was there to meet Father Jim. I was there to become Catholic. I knew that almost from the moment I met Jim, because just too many coincidences were there. And I recognized God's, you know, where God was working at that moment. That's not usually the case. I have to look back and go, oh, that was God. Or, ooh, that wasn't. You know, and a lot of times it's like, ooh, that was Tim again. You know, that wasn't God. And so I have to make amends. I've talked for a while, but there are some things that I want to point out. First of all, in AA, we've got some traditions, right? And the traditions are in place to kind of keep us united. There's a few of them that I think are really important. Actually, they're all really important, but I'm going to read a couple of short forms and a couple of long forms. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery, that's my life, by the way, personal recovery, depends upon AA unity. If we're doing something in an AA meeting that's not unifying, we need to stop, whatever that might be. If we're trying to be divisive, we need to stop. My personal recovery depends upon AA. I couldn't do this without AA. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism, hence we may refuse none who wish to recover. I don't get to pick and choose. If they want to recover from alcoholism, they're welcome in an AA group. They may have all sorts of other issues going on that maybe we can find help for them, maybe not, but you know, if they wish to recover from alcoholism, AA is the place. Nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group, they have no other affiliation. Very important. Here's one that I absolutely love, and the reason that I'm talking about it tonight, step 10, or tradition 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn in a public controversy. We hear that at meetings all the time. We don't hear this all the time, and I want to read it. No AA group or member should ever, in such a way as to implicate AA, express any opinion on outside controversial issues, particularly those of politics, alcohol reform, or sectarian religion. The Alcoholics Anonymous groups oppose no one. Concerning such matters, they can express no views whatever. I get really nervous in an AA meeting when I hear people naming their personal God. I get real nervous. You see who I am. You can probably figure out who my personal God is. However, you know, I don't name that God. It's God as I understand God. Higher power. Those are sufficient. You know, I sat in a meeting one time where there was a guy with a yarmulke, so I'm guessing he was Jewish. There was a guy with a turban. I'm guessing that he may have been a Sikh. I'm not sure. And I knew I was a Catholic priest. And we didn't get into any kind of an argument about God as we understood God, because that's how we identified it. God as I understand God. My higher power. I don't have to name that higher power. I certainly don't need to tell anybody what my political affiliation is. You know, I mean, those things really can be divisive. The AA program, I think, stands because the promises come true. There are so many promises in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to talk about just a couple and then I'm going to close. We know about the promises on page 83 and 84. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We'll discover that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. We know those promises. I know that at 2.5 years sober when I lost that job, that idea of fear of people and of economic insecurity came true. I no longer had fear of economic insecurity. I had economic insecurity, right? And Alcoholics Anonymous helped me work my way through it. It's as simple as that. There's third step promises on page 62 and 63. It says we have to quit playing God. And if we're willing to do that, all sorts of remarkable things will occur. The 10-step promises. It says continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. These are on page 84. It says, you know, by this time we will have ceased fighting anything or anyone, for by this time sanity will have returned. What a wonderful promise. There's even a promise in this book for Al-Anons. It's on page 23. It says, once in a while, he may tell the truth. It's in there. Look it up. My absolute favorite promise in the entire Big Book is on page 100. It says, when we look back, we realize that the things that come to us, when we put ourselves in God's hands, were better than anything we could have planned. That's my story. Thanks for listening.